I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The name Hitchcock conjures up images of a screaming Janet Leigh and flocks of truly angry birds. But a new film looks at the love story between the director and his wife. This hour, our indie, foreign, and documentary film critics will pull back the curtain on their favorites for this week and this year. So pull up a chair and watch a Frenchman commit a terrible crime that clarifies his world, and an Israeli man uncovers his own family's dark secrets from the war. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The best movies of 2012? We don't have just one list, we've got three, and our independent documentary and foreign film critics have come bearing them like the great gifts they are. They have something else too, reviews of new films opening up this weekend. Those new films include Hitchcock, The Big Picture, and The Flat, a documentary about an Israeli who discovers his grandparents were friends with a powerful Nazi. Well, our film critics, once again, our film professor, Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, happy holidays to you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR's own Steve Walker is here. Stephen, good
Thanks
morning.
Thanks for calling me a gift.
Yes.
Or did I misread that?
No, it's your list that's the gift,
oh,
not
see.
You.
Sorry.
Yeah. And Bob Butler, who writes about film at butlercinemascene.com. He works at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Bob, good morning to you.
Season's greetings.
We're going to save our list of the best films for just a little while here. So let's start with some films that are currently showing. And here's one, Steve Walker. It's called The Big Picture. It's a French suspense drama about a man who has everything and commits a crime that changes his life.
Right. This movie just showed up out of nowhere, and it's really good. It's this really tight psychological thriller. This lawyer's on a fast track. His mentor is Catherine Deneuve in a little cameo who owns this law firm that she's going to leave to him. And he starts early in the movie. He's not that happily married. He's very good at his job, but he starts to suspect his wife is cheating on him. And one thing leads to another. They have dinner at the neighbor's. And then the man who lives there is a photographer for National Geographic, or so he says. And then he kills him in a fight, accidentally. This is in the first few minutes, so we're not spoiling anything. And then, like a Ripley, Talented Mr. Ripley, or one of Patricia Highsmith's novels, or an old Hitchcock story, he assumes this man's identity, gets rid of the body, which takes forever, gets a new passport, picks up a camera, moves to Hungary, where this photographer said he was going to shoot some photographs, and all of a sudden he's this new person. And it's just really fascinating to watch this new life unfold while the old life and the old crime are still kind of there.
Steve, the new element is the internet. And the first time this guy is Googled, I'm not going to go any further, but, he realizes, oh, my gosh, there's information on the internet about me, and how is he going to deal with that? And it just – it twists and turns throughout the, 2 hour? Mm-hmm. And it's incredibly entertaining. You cannot predict every twist and turn that's happening, that which, you know, just pulls you along, keeps you interested. And I found it very entertaining. I liked it a lot.
I actually think of it as more of a character study than even a thriller, because it's about a man who gets the chance to become what he has always dreamed of becoming. This guy has – one of the things they set up very early is the victim of the crime is a photographer who stuck with being a photographer, whereas our hero always wanted to be a photographer but gave it up for the law. And now he can afford in his basement this huge dark room, but he doesn't do anything but drink in there. Now he's thrown into the shoes of a man who is a professional photographer, and suddenly he realizes his lifelong ambition is coming true. The only problem is he really can't afford to become too famous.
Right.
Someone's going to notice he's not who he says he is.
He has an exhibit at a gallery in Hungary, in this village, beautiful part of Hungary, wherever it is. But he's like, no interviews, nothing, no pictures. And then these other people start coming. This gallery owner from London says, we love your work. We want you to...
No, it's already booked. He has no choice.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I can't be seen. My whole story is going to unravel. And so just watching all of this go on, like Cynthia said, and... is really
entertaining. And he's an excellent actor. One of my favorite films of all time is called Heartbreaker. It's a lightweight comedy, and he plays a guy who is hired by parents, you know, to keep their child from marrying someone.
Yes, this fellow's name is Romain Duris, mm-hmm. who is a – I think that's how it's pronounced in French.
Right.
I wouldn't know for sure, but he's really quite good.
How's Catherine Deneuve?
She's always Catherine
Deneuve. Always the most beautiful thing on the planet. But her scenes are very short. She's just got a couple scenes.
But it's nice that she's not the love interest, that she's not just a grandparent, that she's not. She's the head of a law firm.
And she is how old these days?
Don't know.
She's
could be Googled.
She's got to be 70 now.
Early 70s.
Yeah.
Boy,
she's amazing.
She is such a presence
So
long.
Right.
So.
It's very entertaining, and it just opened today, and I had heard nothing about it till I heard Jerry at the Tivoli was bringing it.
It's going to be at the Tivoli. It's in French, Serbian, and English.
Yeah. I'm sitting here. I was telling our film critics before the show that I'm off next week, and my plans are to go, you know, spend like an afternoon and watch two or three movies like you guys get to do every day.
Oh,
to me, it's like the great decadence, the great pleasure
no.
of all time. Sounds
Steve,
like
I'm watching screeners at 4 in the morning because of my other job.
Ooh,
so that's
man.
Not how that works.
Shall I tell him my philosophy
yeah.
anymore? Yes. Well, at my stage of life, Steve, it's not the $10. It's the 2 hours.
Oh, that's the bigger issue. Yeah, yeah. Well, how many movies are you seeing this time of year with this flood of end-of-year titles sort of hitting us right
not
now?
Not nearly as many as we should. I don't know about you guys, but I got a stack about a foot high of Academy Award screeners. These are movies that some of which have opened, some of which won't open here until the new year. And they expect us to see them all before the end of the year. Sorry, guys.
There's no way.
Yeah. I got over 125 screeners in the past month and a half.
Wow. So. 125.
Yeah.
Have you seen all those?
I have, oddly
really?
Enough. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Get a life, Cindy.
I know. I want to after today.
Yeah. Our next film today is one that's gotten a little bit of buzz, Hitchcock, a fictionalized drama about the making of Alfred Hitchcock's famous film, Psycho, Cynthia Haynes.
Okay, so you've got Anthony Hopkins playing Hitchcock. It's not too much of a stretch. I mean,
yes.
he did go through, you know, I think it was a 6-hour makeup experience, you know, to get the jowls and everything right. And has wonderful Helen Mirren playing his wife, totally miscast in as far as the real Alma is concerned. I taught a course on Hitchcock for years and years and years, and there's a much more interesting story. I think Hopkins didn't get Hitchcock right. I think Hitchcock, to some extent, was a bit creepy in a way.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he played him kind of as a, you know, goofy guy who liked to do pranks and whatever. And Alma is truly the power behind the throne because she worked on every one of his scripts, brought him ideas, but she was a very small, mousy woman. And I don't care what Helen Mirren does, she's not small and she's not well, she's not huge, but she's not mousy. So the point is, there's tension between the two of them because he did fall for these blonde women. He did cast these women. And he did have sexual interest in these characters. And, you know, Alma was sort of left behind. So that's.
And nobody leaves Helen Mirren behind.
That's true.
And the story doesn't capture
so,
that, you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, that component of it. You know, he used his TV crew to make the film because it was a very, very low budget and he had to put his own money into it. So the strange thing is that there was another, and this happened with Capote, that there was another
Hitchcock movie
on television.
On HBO. It's called The Girl.
You saw it.
It's about the making of The Birds and Marnie and about Hitchcock's fascination to the point of scary, stalking, sexualized weirdness with Tippi Hedren, who was the star of The Birds and Marnie. That movie is much better than Hitchcock.
You know, it's interesting. Hitchcock, as far as it's about the making of a classic film, it's fun. I like the behind-the-scenes stuff. I find that enjoyable. I think when they try to get into the Hitchcock's marriage, that's when it runs aground for me. They've even gone to the point of arranging a sort of affair for Alma with another screenwriter who's like cozying up to her in the hopes that some of her genius will rub off on his next screenplay. That part of the story I just never bought.
Well, and that's what sold. I mean, this script's been floating around, or this story, for years in Hollywood. And they said, well, you know, we're going to make it if we can show that relationship. I don't think they pulled it off. Patricia Hitchcock is their only child, their daughter, and she is the keeper of the flame. And a lot of his films have been reissued with commentary and introductions by her. I think she's got to be furious right now. They wouldn't allow any footage from the movie Psycho to be used in the film. But there's a point – we have to realize there's a whole generation out there, Bob, that doesn't even know who Alfred Hitchcock is.
Yeah.
They think he's just this large guy who did a TV show and was kind of funny. But beyond that, they don't know about Psycho. They don't know about Hitchcock. So who are we trying to appeal to? Is this older audience? And I just don't think it's
– I have no idea. It's a pointless movie. It's like, why is this movie even – why was it even made? It makes no
sense. How does Anthony Hopkins, one of our great actors, how does he miss on portraying Alfred Hitchcock to the extent that you're saying that he did?
I don't know.
I don't think he misses that badly. Now, I'll tell you what. When you look at him full face, the makeup doesn't convince me this is Hitchcock. However, in profile and with those plummy vocal tones and the way he moves, sometimes like a dancing bear, sometimes like, you know, a rock, I kind of felt he physically got Hitchcock down. But, again, I don't think any of us were 100% on this.
It's interesting. A guy named Sasha Gervasi has not made a feature film before, and that was a mistake. I think that's part of the problem with the film. The only movie he's made so far is a documentary called Anvil, The Story of Anvil, which is
a great documentary about a struggling, rock band.
Explain something to me, then. I've never understood this. So how does a first-time director like this man you're describing, Sasha Gervasi, how does he get to do a film with these two heavyweight actors, Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren? How does that happen?
Why do you trust
a newcomer with that much money and responsibility?
This is Hollywood. And from what I read in the Hollywood Reporter, actually, that one of the producers was a big fan of this documentary. So his name was on the short list of filmmakers.
And I'll be willing to bet that once they went around and said, well, ignore our director, we've got Hopkins and Helen Mirren, people in Hollywood are probably saying, well, let me get my wallet out.
Mm-hmm.
That just sounds like
this film. Yeah. We have a clip here from the film.
Yes, this is Hitchcock and his wife, Alma, discussing the fact that nobody will finance this film, Psycho.
Well, you'd better enjoy the pool, my dear, while you can. We might not have it much longer.
Why?
Paramount refuses to finance the movie.
Oh, Hitch, I'm so sorry.
You can't find the money, at least not fast enough.
Well, why not wait?
No. I'm just going to have to go it alone, our girl. Finance it ourselves.
Well, are we going to have to sell the whole house or just the pool?
I just want to do the film.
I should point out this film has some other big-time actors in it. Scarlett Johansson, Jessica Biel. That's a pretty good cast.
I think they felt uncomfortable. I don't think they did a good job in the film.
No.
You're okay. Toni Collette was, I think, fine as Hitch's girl Friday.
Well, she was always fine. But The Girl on HBO is a much better film and a deeper examination of Hitchcock's sexual problems.
Yes. So in terms of recommending this film, Steve Walker's
no. not at all.
No.
I'm giving it a yes, no. If you love Hitchcock, if you're into Psycho and you want the backstory, you'll probably find yourselves diverted here.
So a yes, no from Bob Butler. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUI. We're talking with our film critics about the latest and best documentary foreign films now out on the screen. We're talking now about The Flat, Steve Walker. It's a documentary about an Israeli who discovers that his grandparents were friends with a powerful Nazi.
Right. He's a filmmaker living in Tel Aviv. His grandmother dies, and the whole family kind of gathers to go through her things.
Mm-hmm.
And they start digging into books and photo albums, and they find this article that's titled A Nazi Goes to Palestine. And that's kind of fascinating to the younger members of the family. They're like, why would my grandmother have this article and these pictures? And it turns out that his grandparents were, after the war was over, were friends with this Nazi officer.
And before the war.
Right.
Yes.
Even though, I mean, and as the movie goes on, we keep learning all these other things that happened. What happened to his great-grandmother? Why is his mother, who's still alive, and it was her mother that had just passed away, his Nana, is denying that she knows anything about what happened to his her parents. And it's just, to me, this movie is about the power of anybody, human, and to deny something horrible from their past, to just put your blinders on, move forward, it's too painful, and it didn't happen.
You know, it's fascinating to me that there are things going on here I didn't know about. For instance, this newspaper article they come across is from a Nazi newspaper called The Attack. And apparently the German fellow, the German man and his wife who accompanied the Jewish grandparents on this tour of Palestine in 1936, his name was von Mildenstein, he was there to find a way to export all of Germany's Jews to the Middle East. Then they decided a little bit later on that the final solution would be easier.
Hmm.
It's just eerie. And yet the grandparents of this Jewish filmmaker were so German in their identity that even though they fled Germany before World War II broke out and ended up in Palestine, after the war, they kept indulging that German side of their personality to the point of reestablishing contact with this Nazi guy who'd been in the SS, who was replaced in his job by Adolf Eichmann. I mean, this was no innocent.
Wow.
And this German, after the war, became the publicist for Coca-Cola in Germany.
Oh, really?
I mean, is that eerie?
When I first started watching it, I thought, okay, you know, somebody's home movies, who cares about this? And then once again, there's a twist, there's a turn in the story, and I couldn't stop watching it until the very end. And I kept thinking, all nationalities could identify with the fact that there are family secrets. And which generation is the one who asks the questions? And what do we learn about history? I mean, this could have been just another Holocaust-themed movie, but it isn't. I mean, I think it has broader implications and a very, very compelling documentary.
And with any great documentary, the filmmaker starts with one agenda and then discovers information
that he
could never have planned for. And so the movie takes a turn, and we watch him turn and adjust his thinking about his own family as the twists and turns continue.
Well, not just that. He's befriended by von Mildenstein's daughter, who is now in her 70s.
Right.
She
that's
is so
right.
friendly. She and her husband take him in, and it soon becomes apparent that this woman is in massive denial about the role of her father, and it becomes the filmmaker's – he has to ask himself, what do I tell this woman about her father that I have discovered?
Right.
Do I destroy her image of her father?
Right.
Benefit anybody?
Bob, there are no real answers to that question, but the filmmaker does bring a psychiatrist to the screen who offers a plausible explanation as to mm-hmm. why this happened. So it's worth watching it to the very end to get, you know, this possible reason that.
And what's interesting, Bob, about that point is that both families are denying something related to the Holocaust
yeah.
but from very obviously different sides.
Yes.
Okay. That movie, again, is The Flat. It opens today. Opened last week at the Tivoli, right?
Yes.
Okay. How about a film that's got just so much going on with it, Anna Karenina? It's an adaptation of the epic love story set in 19th century high society, written by Leo Tolstoy.
Great a great novel. Some people say it's the greatest novel ever written. Now, you mentioned it's a love story, and on the screen it has been a love story. I maintain that Tolstoy never meant for it to be a love story. It was a calculating, cold, and some would say cruel dissection of czarist society and of a woman who acts like Madame Bovary selfishly and brings all sorts of grief down.
Is now, corrupt, yes.
Yeah. Now, Joe Wright wrote and directed this and stars, and his star, of course, is Keira Knightley, with whom he made a really nice version, I thought, of Pride and Prejudice a few years back. The interesting thing about this to me is the way in which he has chosen to depict it. Most of the film unfolds in a very non-realistic manner in a what looks like the Bolshoi Theater. And different parts of the theater, everything from the fly loft to the basement to the rooms on the side, become settings. And even a horse race takes place on the stage of the theater with real horses galloping by.
Yeah, That scene is extraordinary. Spectacular.
And to me, I have problems with the film because I don't think Keira Knightley is quite up to the depth that this requires. But the magnificence of Wright's vision, the way he has mounted this, the staging of it, made it to me one of the more interesting films of the year.
I kept thinking of Baz Luhrmann.
I did too, yeah.
As I was watching.
Who?
Because that is a film.
Baz Luhrmann, who directed Moulin Rouge and that wonderful Romeo and Juliet with DiCaprio and Claire Danes.
Yeah.
It's something he would do. I disagree with you about Keira Knightley. I think she played her as a disturbed, compulsive woman, and that worked for me. I mean, she wasn't sympathetic necessarily.
This is not a warm and fuzzy romance, any stretch.
It certainly isn't. And so it's more about lust than it is about love.
I think Knightley's very good. I have to correct you, though. It was Tom Stoppard wrote this film, the great playwright.
Right.
But you can't even talk about and describe how weird this movie looks when they set all these scenes in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to get Keira Knightley's dressing room, they roll pieces of set furniture onto the set like you're watching a play change scenes. And she's standing up in the wings up above on the catwalks looking down at her life unraveling. I think some of these things, if you read between the lines, you really get where he's going. That horse race scene is spectacular.
And it works.
Jude Law's very good as her scorned husband.
You actually feel sorry for the guy.
He's really been played
as a real cold villain, but in this you actually kind of ache for him.
My only problem with the film is the whole subplot, which is apparently a huge part of the book, about a relative of Keira Knightley's character named Kitty and her beau named Levin, who's a farmhand, basically.
Well, he's landed gentry who works with the peasants, and I think Tolstoy saw him as an embodiment of what Russia could become if it got rid of this crusty old, nobility.
Mm-hmm. All of those scenes are filmed very realistically.
In real fields.
To contrast the theatricalized, stylized scenes of the other. And I don't think it works at all, and they spend way too much time on it.
This is the 11th version of this story.
Is it really?
So, yes. And Greta Garbo did a version, and I meant to watch it before the show. But
this film is so lush, at least based on what I've seen in the coming attractions. And there's so many great actors here. Why isn't this an A-plus movie?
It's doing well.
I think it's good.
And it's been nominated for...
But it's gotten sort of... It's B grades, not A grades.
I think that's because of the stylized nature of a lot of the film.
Well,
I think people aren't used to seeing movies like this.
Here's the trick. I think most previous versions have treated this as a sweeping love story.
Right.
Wright, I think, grabs hold of Tolstoy's true intention, which is just the opposite of a sweeping romantic love story. But from the audience point of view... Darn it, we want our sweeping romantic love story. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff
I think you're right.
The stuff about the corruption of czarist society, blah, 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 blah. Give me some, hot and bothered. That's why I'm here for a romance.
There's a scene, real quick, the costume design is spectacular, too. And there's a scene of my friend of mine pointed out that as Knightley's unraveling and realizing her marriage is over and her reputation and everything, she's wearing not her dress, but the skeleton of the dress. You know how those old dresses would have these huge hoops? And
mm-hmm.
She's walking around in her living room screaming and weeping. And my friend said, she is, her skeleton is exposed. That's how much pain she's in. Mm-hmm. And that was, again, probably something Joe Wright came up with.
Bob, what's the clip we have here?
Well, what is the clip we have here? This is, you know, I don't know.
We can just listen to it and find out.
I think it's a summary of the plot.
This is her. Is this her talking to her husband or to her lover?
To her lover.
All right.
From Anna Karenina.
Well, love was never a game to us. Here's an end to living in corners, existing day to day on lies.
Yes. Now we can be together.
How can we, Alexei?
Tell Karenin everything.
Do you think my husband will make you a present of me?
Leave him.
Leave him and be your mistress.
Yes. Run away.
I would never see my son again. The laws are made by husbands and fathers.
What then? I'll never forgive myself for your unhappiness.
Unhappiness? I'm like a starving beggar who's been given food. I unhappy. No. This is my happiness.
Okay.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our romp through the latest foreign independent and documentary films. We'll turn to Silver Linings Playbook, and we'll talk about a film not here yet, Hyde Park on the Hudson. That's the film about FDR being played by Bill Murray, right? Lots of talk about that one, too. And we'll have our best films of the year, our list of top 10 from each of our critics for the best films of 2012. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's discussion about family stress during the holidays, you can find it in our weekend to-do list at kcur.org. On Monday's program, we'll talk about early childhood education and why teaching the ABCs early on can help develop a strong economy. This hour, we're talking with our art, independent, and foreign film critics. They are Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. And Bob Butler, you're up next with Silver Linings Playbook. A young man returns home after spending time in a mental hospital. What happens then?
Well, you know what? It's pretty hard to make a movie that about mental illness that is both serious, it's a serious topic, and often hysterically funny. This one pulls it off. It was made by David O. Russell, who years ago did Three Kings, one of the best movies ever about the first Gulf War. And then, just a couple years ago, he came back with The Fighter with Mark Wahlberg, a terrific movie. I think he's done it again with this one. What you've got is Bradley Cooper as a young man who, well, I don't know how young he is, but he's middle-aged at this point. He's come back to live with his parents after spending the better part of a year in a mental hospital. His wife left him, and he went berserk. And now he is still obsessive. He still has a hard time controlling his feelings, and he says inappropriate things, but he's working hard at it. And that's and so we're rooting for him. Then you've got the It Girl, Jennifer Lawrence, who plays a recently widowed young woman who, in effect, kind of starts stalking him. Wouldn't you say that's almost what
yes.
she does?
Mm-hmm.
On the other, you know, that's a little disturbing, but hey, it's Jennifer Lawrence, so stalk away. Anyway, this all takes place in Philadelphia against the background of a football season. It turns out that our young man's father, played by Robert De Niro, is a bit of an obsessive character himself when it comes to the Philadelphia Eagles, and he's running a betting shop out of his house since he lost his job. Now, none of this sounds terrifically promising at this point, but the key to the film, I think, is that little by little, we start connecting with these characters. They are very funny, and the boy and the girl basically decide to enter a dance contest. That sounds like such a hoary plot development, and yet it's absolutely crucial to this movie working in the end. It gives them something to do. It forces them to be together. Of course, it develops into a love story, but a very funny and touching love story.
I think you're right. It could have gone off the rails so many times and in so many ways.
It did.
And I think the script kept it on track, and Jennifer Lawrence's smart, brazen, sad character, her performance is terrific. It's the best performance by a woman I've seen all year, is young 21, 22-year-old Jennifer Lawrence in this movie.
Steve, I agree with you. I think the best performance in this film is Jennifer Lawrence's, but I think it was so uneven in tone. There were moments where it was absolutely silly. There were moments when it was absolutely funny, and there were moments of darkness that didn't necessarily relate to Bradley Cooper's character's problems, and I think he just played him as an arrogant, self-centered guy. I think he missed the boat. I don't think he did a good job in this at all. Then you got Robert De Niro taking this way too seriously in terms of his compulsion about betting, and so it just didn't mesh for me.
Really?
It really didn't. Jackie Weaver, the same thing. I mean, either, not that it has to have a consistent comic tone or a consistent dramatic tone. It had both, but it just didn't work for me.
Well, we got a clip here.
Yes.
This is Jennifer Lawrence explaining to Bradley Cooper kind of what she's been through in recent months.
How'd you lose your job?
Having sex with everybody in the office.
Everybody?
I was very depressed after Tommy died. It was a lot of people.
We don't have to talk about it.
Thanks.
How many were there?
11.
Wow.
I know.
I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
Can I ask you one more question? Were there any women?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
What was that like?
Hot.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Now, the gentlemen around here are laughing. That is supposed to be a funny scene. If the rest of the movie was like that, I would recommend it.
I bought it. And I don't like sports. I bought the whole football, the odds betting. I think De Niro has been phoning in performances for years, and I think he's quite good in this, too. Cooper did nothing for me, basically. But Lawrence, I didn't want her to leave the screen. Every time she was off the screen, I was like, bring her back.
You're saying the great De Niro has been filming it in for years?
Yes.
I've seen some recent films of his that they've been okay.
But have you seen the ones that have gone straight to DVD?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, I haven't either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so,
you
know.
Which there have been a few.
He's had a bad case recently of don't send the script, send the check.
Right.
Well, okay. Bob Butler, some events coming up at the Kansas City Public Library. Movies that matter. What movies matter, Bob?
Well, we've just wrapped it up last weekend for this year. We showed Snow White and had a bunch of kids come. That was fantastic. But first Sunday of the new year, we're showing what I consider to be possibly the greatest film of all time. Boy, that's going to be a tough one to live up to. Anyway, it's Carl Dreyer's silent movie, The Passion of Joan of Arc, which is just utterly beautiful and smashing. Anyway, this month, though, just in case the Mayans are right, we've been showing apocalypse movies, and on Monday night at the downtown library, we're showing The Road, which is a tremendous film based on the Cormac McCarthy Pulitzer Prize-winning novel about cannibals and whatever. We're also showing on Saturday afternoons different variations of A Christmas Carol. I believe the last two Sundays were showing Scrooged with Bill Murray and Scrooged, the 1970 musical with Albert Finney. So there's a lot going on at the library, and as always, it's free.
How about the End of Watch re-release?
Well, what happens is that filmmakers, or distributors actually, in studios realize that they've often released a movie too early to get into that Oscar mix. And that's what happened with this film. And it's not doing well second time around, although it's a very, very good movie.
Terrific movie.
Yeah, you guys, where can we see the movie? End of Watch, which you guys raved about. I think the performances by Jake Gyllenhaal.
And, on my list. Yeah.
And both of them have been nominated for some awards. So
I go to the smallest auditorium in any AMC theater, and there it'll
you'll
be.
Find it.
Right. It's out in the main, on the plaza.
They brought it back, yeah.
Okay, that film again, End of Watch, high praise from critics. Some movies that are coming out in the weeks to come. Cynthia?
Well, the one that I have not seen, and both these gentlemen have seen, is
Zero Dark Thirty. Okay, it's been getting, there's been articles in the New York Times
about
it.
That's the Bin Laden film.
That's the Catherine Bigelow's film about the hunt for and killing of Bin Laden. There's been all kinds of op-eds. Maureen Dowd's writing about it. Frank Bruni's writing about it. There's been an article almost every day. It's a tremendous film, and I know it's on my top 10, which we'll get to eventually. Yeah. I know we will.
It opens in Kansas City, January the 11th. The other one is Les Miserables, or Les Miserables, or however you want to pronounce it, opens Christmas Day. Has the most extraordinary 4.5 minutes I've ever seen on film, and that's of Anne Hathaway singing I Dream a Dream. Incredibly profound and moving. The rest of the film left me cold. It's an emotional roller coaster in one take of an actress who goes
singing live.
They all sing live in the film. They musicals are usually lip sync. Yeah. I don't like Anne Hathaway. I thought she was overacting so much up until this song, and the camera never moves from her face, and tears were streaming down my face. I was going, oh my God, she's going to win the Oscar. I usually predict supporting actress on this show, and I just did.
The movie is made by Tom Hooper, who gave us the King's Speech a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And he has really moved into from basically an independent film into big league movie making. I don't know. I've seen Les Mis. I saw it when it first came out on Broadway. I've seen about 4 or 5 stage shows. And every time I turn on my PBS station, they got the concert version going. And I thought I was totally burned out on this show. But I have to say, I think they did a terrific,
job
of translating it to the screen.
Yeah. And here's a film I've seen so many coming attractions for, and I can't figure out, as can Cynthia, why this thing is opening up on Christmas. Django Unchained.
I don't get it.
Directed by Quentin Tarantino.
It's Quentin Tarantino. You remember his last one was Inglourious Basterds, which was a Jewish revenge fantasy about killing Hitler. This is a African-American slavery fantasy about
a black
slave who becomes a gunslinger and basically takes it out on, those pompous white plantation owners. Yeah, I saw it.
Oh, you saw it. I haven't seen it either.
People are claiming that this is absolutely fantastic. I happen to think it's the least of Quentin Tarantino's films, so there's going to be a lot of headbutting over
this.
And
it stars?
It stars Jamie Foxx and Christoph Waltz, who, of course, was the Oscar winner for Inglourious Basterds.
And also
Leonardo DiCaprio slave owner. Yeah,
Who plays a plantation owner named Calvin Candy and calls his plantation Candyland, which will give you an idea of the kind of hip
or not.
Aggressiveness you'll find here.
Well, isn't it supposed to have been done in the spaghetti western style?
Very much so, absolutely.
Then there's a film titled The Impossible. It's based on a true story of a family separated following the tsunami in Thailand.
Incredibly disturbing. I couldn't look at half of it. It's about parents looking for their three kids following a tsunami.
And Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor.
It is so disturbing. We'll review it.
I think it's important, even if it is disturbing.
I didn't care for it at all.
Well, anyway, we'll discuss it and on the next show. Promised Land is also coming
up.
Matt Damon film.
It's about a gas company employee who has second thoughts about the impact of fracking, which is happening in Kansas on Midwest farmers.
A little bit of a soap opera here. We don't need to review them, but we just want to give people a heads up as to what's coming. Directed by Gus Van Sant, who did Goodwill Hunting with Damon.
And then there, of course, is Hyde Park on the Hudson, a month in June of 1939. In the life of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Bill Murray plays FDR.
It just doesn't sound right.
It doesn't sound right.
I have to say, though, that before it was over, I found myself on the wavelength.
You bought it.
Yeah, I did. It's not like he's trying to do an absolutely, total impersonation. But he captures some very key elements of this guy that we all know from our dimes, but at the time of his presidency, there was a lot going on in his life that the press covered up, and much of that is being exposed in this. In fact, I understand a lot of the FDR descendants are kind of hacked off at the filmmakers.
And it co-stars Laura Linney, who is terrific in just about
can
everything.
Can almost do no wrong.
She talked about it this morning on Morning Edition, actually.
Did
a little interview with her, yeah.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the latest foreign and documentary independent films now showing with Cynthia Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. How about some DVDs, video on demand opportunities in the weeks ahead?
Bob, the only thing we have listed is Mel Brooks box set.
You know what? Yeah, I don't know how many of you out there are Mel Brooks geeks.
Lots of people are.
You probably know, of course, that all the movies he's made have been on DVD forever. But Rhino, the Shout Factory, I guess, came out with a box set. It's got something like 6 DVDs of Mel, what shall we call this? Obscurantia. It's got every appearance he ever made on The Tonight Show. It's got his Oscar-winning short film, The Critic, an animated film from the 60s. It's got seen an entire episode of Get Smart. In other words, it's kind of like everything you want to know about Mel Brooks outside the films themselves, although he talks about each one of his films and does a little 10-minute, you know, almost like a director's commentary on him. So if you're a Mel Brooks freak and you love the 2,000-year-old man,
it would make a good gift.
It would make
for the holidays.
For your man cave, yeah.
I recommend renting Beasts of the Southern Wild and Moonrise Kingdom that are both on DVD right now.
Oh, they're both out. Beasts of the Southern Kingdom's out already, eh?
Okay. Beasts of the Southern Wild and Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah, okay. Let's turn to some discussion about the best films of 2012. And I guess maybe one way to begin, Cynthia, the New York Times has reviewed 800 films in 2012. I think they said that was a record for them in any one year. Lots of movies out there. How's the quality these days?
Francis Ford Coppola said many, many, many years ago in an interview that with digital cameras now, there's going to be a democracy out there in terms of who gets to make what and who gets to speak through film. There's a lot of garbage out there right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody and his brother is picking up a camera and thinking that, you know, they can tell a story, and they're finding it's a lot more difficult. There's a documentary called Side by Side, which is about this transition from analog to digital technology, which is revolutionizing the film business, which is the reason we have movies like Life of Pi that have come out. So I did want to mention, before I rattle on about anything else, that I will be in Los Angeles on January the 10th for the Critics' Choice Movie Awards.
Yeah,
it's going to be on at 7 or 8 o'clock on the CW channel. And the 10 pictures I'm going to mention have been nominated for Best Film of the Year. Penelope Cruz is not going to be there this year, but Javier Bardem will be. So I just,
Here's my question. The top 10% of the films made this year, how does that compare to the top 10% in recent years?
Bob thinks it's terrific, and I think it's pretty spare.
It took me so long to come up with the top 10, and I was throwing things out that I dearly loved. That, to me, is a sign of a good year.
Hmm. Steve?
I had 9 that stood out for me, and then as I got to the 10th, I had about 10 movies I was juggling until yesterday.
And Cynthia, did you have trouble coming up with the top 10?
Not really, but there's some very small, once again, independent films. And if we look at these lists that have come out from the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, from the Golden Globes, the movies that we talk about on this show are the ones that are getting nominated for awards. Now, Moonrise Kingdom is on my list. It's not a fabulous, $100 million budget movie, and it wouldn't necessarily be on a list in previous years, but this year it did stand out.
Well, this is kind of interesting because in the right hands, a big budget is not a bad thing. A big budget made Life of Pi.
Yeah.
A big budget made Les Miserables.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is money well spent, in my humble opinion. Argo was probably a pretty expensive movie to make, and big dividends there, too. It's not like just because it's a popular success, it has to be bad. Although, if you take that attitude, you'll generally be right. What I'm finding looking at my list is that it's almost evenly divided between what I'd have to call studio movies and independent movies. I think that's healthy.
I think there are more documentaries that were better than feature films this year myself.
Well, that's usually the case.
Let's get to some lists here. Cynthia, why don't you kick it off with your 10? And remind us, if you will, as you go through some of these films that haven't been around for a while. Maybe we talked about some of them today, but remind us what they're about if they're a few months old.
Beasts of the Southern Wild, I think, was one of the more original films of the year, where using this digital technology and small cameras and using non-professional actors worked. It was a real challenge for the filmmaker to tell the story of what a 10-year-old little girl who is the victim of this horrible – it's not necessarily Katrina, but it's a natural disaster, and how she contends with it and with the people in her life. I thought it was amazing, and the young girl has been nominated for a lot of awards for her performance. It's very, very well done.
Also on your list?
Is Lincoln – got to be. There are some flaws in Lincoln. Sometimes I think I greatly admire Steven Spielberg as a filmmaker. There's no doubt about it. But every once in a while, he kind of gives us the Disney version. There are a couple of scenes in Lincoln I thought should have been left out.
That opening scene where the two African-American soldiers
so
are talking
false.
To the president and then
reciting,
wind up reciting the Emancipation Proclamation. I just about fell off my chair.
Yeah.
Just
We watched
great.
That film with Jonathan Earle, who is a Lincoln expert at the KU.
Yeah.
And he was very impressed how historically accurate the film is. I think this is one of Spielberg's more mature films, but still there are elements in there that aren't. The Master, I thought it was an incredible film
about...
in terms of – it's not about Scientology. It's about cults and leaders of cults. And I think the two actors – Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman are extraordinary. It's a character study. It is not your traditional narrative film, and it didn't appeal to a whole lot of people. I saw one statistic that said more people will see one episode of Mad Men on television than will have seen the movie The Master before it goes to DVD. Also on that list, Anna Karenina, we talked about, Moonrise Kingdom, and Argo, and a film that got totally lost, Lawless, which was set in the Depression era Virginia with Jessica Chastain and Guy Pearce and Tom Hardy, directed by John Hillicoat. Really liked that movie a lot. Then the documentary, Searching for Sugar Man, Ai Weiwei, Marina Abramovic. And then I got to add Queen of Versailles, The Imposter, The Gatekeepers, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, and Comic-Con Episode 4 by Morgan Spurlock.
Whoa.
Great list. Great list. And I should point out that all these picks will be on our website, kcur.org, with trailers that give you a sense of what each of these films are about. On our website, again, kcur.org. Steve Walker, why don't you run with the ball here and tell us your top 10.
I've got a couple on my list that are to be opening soon. And let's start with those. Rust and Bone is a French film with Marion Cotillard, who plays a whale trainer who loses her limbs, her lower legs, in an accident and falls in love with a bare-knuckle fighter. It's extraordinary.
Wow.
It doesn't sound like it should work.
It works beautifully. It's amazing. The Imposter, the documentary about a 13-year-old boy who goes missing in Texas and then shows up 4 years later in Spain, or does he? End of Watch, the LAPD cop movie.
Yeah.
Moonrise Kingdom, we've talked about. Marina Abramovic, The Artist Is Present.
That's on my Netflix queue, real high on the list. I should see it.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
The Queen of Versailles, very entertaining documentary about the collapse of the U.S. economy told through the lives of one family who are constructing what would have been the biggest single family home in the country.
Mm-hmm.
The Master is on my list as well. Bernie is on my list, a comedy with Jack Black and Shirley MacLaine and Matthew McConaughey. Declaration of War was a French film about a young couple whose toddler becomes gravely ill, but it's told with such joy and life that it doesn't come off as a depressing onslaught of heavy emotion. And lastly, Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow's movie about the hunt for bin Laden.
And you liked that film.
I thought it was great.
Wow. Do you have a favorite of the top 10?
The Master.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Bob Butler.
Well, this just goes to show.
You're bringing up the rear.
The Master isn't on my top 10. Lincoln isn't on my top 10.
Lincoln's not on my top 100.
There you go.
No, really.
I'll tell you, two movies that I'm surprised neither of you have mentioned. First, The Sessions, which just blew me away. As for sheer emotional, it's a true story about a man who lived most of his life in an iron lung and decided at the age of 38 it was time to lose his virginity.
Yeah.
We talked about how unlikely this was as a movie topic. I mean, the possibility for messing it up, but John Hawkes, who plays the polio victim, and Helen Hunt is, I thought, just brilliant.
This is something of a comeback film for Helen Hunt.
In a way,
too.
It is. She's been, you know, after she won the Oscar for As Good As It Gets, she made a lot of little movies that really weren't all that good.
But she just hasn't been offered a lot of scripts either.
And I think she's fantastic.
Is that film still showing here?
Yes. And as far as I'm concerned, she's my best actress, choice. Another one that hasn't been mentioned here, it's an art film with a multi-million dollar budget, is The Life of Pi. Some people love it. Some people hate it.
I hate it.
If only for its visual splendor, I think this is something you need to go see, and you need to see it in 3D.
What else do you have, Bob?
Well, let's see. I'm looking at this. I have one thing here. Agnieszka Holland, the great Polish director, did a World War II drama called In Darkness about a Warsaw – I'm not sure it was Warsaw. It was a Polish city – sewer worker who had been – taking the valuables left behind by deported Jews, and he finds himself harboring a dozen or so Jewish refugees in the sewers beneath the city, and he goes from exploiting them to defending them. It's an absolutely brilliant movie.
Yeah, it's very good.
And then finally, this movie didn't open here until, I guess, March or April, although it won the best documentary feature Oscar last year, Undefeated, about a Memphis football team, high school football team, which is just, man, I start choking up just thinking about this movie.
Yeah. Is that film shown? Is it going to show here?
It played here last April, May.
And it's on DVD.
Yeah.
It's on DVD now. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I guess the question on the table then is the question the New York Times raised this week is, are films today as culturally significant as they were 10, 20 years ago? And
I think Bob made a point that it's much like the internet, that there's a niche for every kind of movie these days. I think there's a lot of experimentation. Hugo last year with 3D, Life of Pi this year. I don't think they have that technology down yet. I hate wearing those dark glasses and you flip them back and forth and the image is brighter and whatever. So we're going to be seeing more and more. And Top Gun is coming out in 3D. So they're retrofitting a lot of movies to try to get people who don't have 3D in their homes yet. It's coming. It's available. But they're trying to get more people in movie theaters, and they're staying home because you just as soon watch it on your mobile device as sit there and with someone kicking the back of your chair or spilling a Coke on your feet or whatever. So movie theaters are having a tougher time, I think, than ever before. We'll see more experimentation.
This year I watched a lot more movies on demand. I bought a lot more than I did in a year prior. Couple things I wanted to see really badly, and I knew we're not coming to Kansas City, and, you know, for $7 – you really can't go wrong, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of these films you talked about today are available on demand.
No. I don't think so. Moonrise Kingdom maybe, since it's out
already
on DVD.
It's already been on demand. Yeah.
Okay, Bernie's on DVD and probably available on demand.
Is Top Gun worth it in 3D?
No.
Well, it depends on whether you're a Top Gun fan. I know grown men that absolutely get weak in the knees over Top Gun.
But ask an 18-year-old what's Top Gun and who's Tom Cruise? And
Who knows, eh?
Yeah.
Hey, good list today. Again, they're up on our website, kcur.org, each of our critics' top 10 films of the year. And yes, Cynthia?
Don't forget to tune in January 10th, 8 o'clock on the CW to see the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. I'll be there.
She'll be in the audience, yeah, and she's just bragging again. Hey, thank you all very much. Happy holidays to each of you. That's Bob Butler, Cynthia Haynes, and Steve Walker. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Monday on the program, we'll talk about early childhood education and why teaching the ABCs early can help develop a strong economy. Our show's theme music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.